Well, Paul, thank you very much for this very nice introduction. It is always a pleasure to be here in Hong Kong to meet with you and to interact with the students in this really great program that you put together. I really enjoyed my 12 years here, coming every year for 2 weeks, and I look forward to coming back with my family. Hong Kong is a place that's very close to my heart, and lots of good memories here. So this evening, what I'd like to do is I'd like to share with you some of the work that we've been doing at Carnegie Mellon over the past decade, looking in particular at a side of privacy that for a long time seemed to be beyond the reach of technology. And this has to do with looking specifically at the text of privacy policies. So this might sound like the most boring research topic one could potentially look at, but hopefully I'll be able to make it a bit more interesting. So for those of you who don't necessarily know what privacy is, so privacy is a fundamental human right, and it has to do with our expectation and our right to be able to live free from interference from a variety of different entities, business organizations, government, other individuals that might potentially pester you, stoke you, and the like. And so it's a fundamental human right, but also has, like all fundamental human rights, some constraints in the sense that it might conflict potentially with other considerations. So, for instance, states typically make the argument that you need to give up at least a little bit of your privacy if you want the state to be able to ensure that you're going to remain secure. And so these rights, obviously, they're not absolute rights. They have to be weighed against other types of considerations very often. What I'm going to be talking about more specifically today is about data privacy. And so data privacy is effectively the projection of these expectations when it comes to what happens to data about you. And as you know, we live in a data-centric economy where everything seems to be operating today based on the collection and use of data about you, right? And so there are just so many different ways in which data can be collected today, so many different ways in which it can be used, that it's effectively extremely difficult for people to keep up with all these different types of practices. But there are laws and regulations, including here in Hong Kong, for instance, where you have the data privacy ordinance that was passed in 1997, overhauled in 2013 to reflect some of the recent changes over the past 20 years or so in this space. And in Europe, you have potentially heard about the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, as it's well known, and there are obviously regulations across the world in this space. In the United States, we have a variety of different regulations that pertain to different sectors, different types of areas where data might be collected about you. For instance, I mentioned here COPPA, which is the Children Online Privacy Protection Act that deals with the collection of data about children 13 and under. And so if you look at the way in which these regulations impose some restrictions and some constraints on how data about you might potentially be collected and used, it typically involves the writing of some kind of a privacy policy, which is basically a collection of statements where an organization or an entity will declare what sort of data it might be collecting about you, what it might be able to do with that data, what choices it might potentially give you in terms of whether or not you agree or don't agree with some of the practices described in that policy. And so these privacy policies are ubiquitous these days. They are often referred to also as relating to this concept of notice and choice, which is the basic idea that you have to be informed about practices relating to the collection and use of your data and be given some options in terms of deciding whether or not you're comfortable with these practices. So that's what people refer to when they refer to notice and choice. In practice, as we probably all realize, and I could do a quick show of hands just to verify this, but as we probably realize, nobody reads privacy policies. So how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past month? Right. All right. Over the past year, perhaps a bit of a privacy policy, like the first sentence. Maybe? Anybody? Okay, all right. So I've made my point. I did, because I work in this space, but I'm really an exception. And so these privacy policies, on the surface, they're a good idea, but in practice, they're not really serving the purpose for which they were designed. They're not terribly effective in terms of helping people get a sense that they're actually remaining in control of what happens to their data, what is being done with it, how it can be used, and so on. People often refer to privacy policies as walls of text, and as you know, often you are shown the text of these privacy policies, or at least perhaps just the first screen. Some privacy policies are as much as 10 pages in length, right? So it takes a huge amount of time to actually read these things. And even if you read these things, you may not necessarily understand what you've read. And then you're asked to click, yes, I agree, I have read the text of this privacy policy. And obviously we all do that, but we never know what we've actually agreed to. And so the question is, is it the case that people don't read these policies because they don't care? And so there's a lot of research that has been done over the years, and it's very easy to show that people actually do care about their privacy. They do care about what happens, their data, how that data can be used. And in fact, a variety of different surveys have also shown that, unfortunately, people have reached this state of resignation where, on the one hand, they care about privacy, they wish they knew what was going on with their data, but at the same time, they've given up on the idea of potentially reading these policies and making informed decisions. So there's a state of hopelessness. For instance, a study that was conducted a few years ago in the United States showed that about 91% of people felt that they had lost control over these data collection and use processes over their information. And so the question then is, well, perhaps these privacy policies are just too long, right? Maybe you don't need to tell me, everything that I'm going to find in these privacy policies. Maybe I don't need to read, the 10 pages of text that you might have in a privacy policy. Perhaps all I care about is just a small number of statements. So perhaps we could actually summarize these privacy policies. And so there's been a number of different efforts that have aimed at building various types of summaries of privacy policies. Some of them are graphical in nature, some of them inspired, for instance, by nutrition labels, right? If we can do it for medication and nutrition, perhaps we can also do it for privacy. But a variety of different studies have actually shown that it's nearly impossible to come up with meaningful summaries of privacy policies. Some of these formats are helpful, but they also have limitations. And the limitations come from the fact that either you come up with very succinct summaries, and then people don't necessarily find the information that they're looking for. They're unable to answer critical questions, questions that are critical to them. And if you make them longer, then you go back to being where you are today, which is that nobody's going to read these summaries. And a lot of the challenges have to do with the fact that it's not a one-size-fits-all type of environment. So different people actually have different sets of questions. They care about different sets of issues. They know different things. So you and I may be reading the same privacy policy, if we ever do, but the kinds of things that you might be interested in might be different from the kinds of things that I would be interested in. And so a one-size-fits-all summary is just not going to work. And so this is the state of affairs today. And so we've done some of these studies. An example was a study that was called How Short is Too Short, discussing different types of formats for summarizing privacy policies. And so this is just to motivate the topic of this presentation. So what if instead of trying to automatically build one-size-fits-all summaries, we actually relied on computers to understand the text of these privacy policies? What if we relied on these computers to then sort of bridge the gap and enable us to perhaps just find information that we care about, enable also regulators that also rely on privacy policies to determine whether a given technology is compliant with relevant regulations, support all sorts of other things that you might potentially want to do? And so that's what I'm going to be discussing today. And so our work in this area started nearly 10 years ago, and the first thing that you have to do if you want to train computers to understand the text of privacy policies is you have to actually build a corpus of data so that you can start training classifiers, so that you can effectively train computers to recognize different types of statements in the text of privacy policies. And so we've built the largest corpus of privacy policy annotations that can be found today. It's a corpus that consists of 115 privacy policies that have been annotated by at least three different people, looking at a number of different types of practices that are disclosed in privacy policies. And so the way in which we did that is by building an annotation tool that enables people to effectively highlight the text in the text of privacy policies, highlight different fragments of text that pertain to different types of practices as they are being disclosed. So, for instance, you might be interested in knowing about first-party statements found in the text of privacy policies. What is a first-party statement? A first-party statement has to do with practices that the website or that the mobile app that you're looking at is going to be relying on to collect your data, so or to potentially use your data. So what is the first party doing? The first party refers to the entity that actually controls the technology that you're interacting with, that controls the process with which you're interacting. That's the first party. A third party, on the other hand, might be an entity that is not that first party, but that might be involved in collecting or processing some of your data. So third-party practices would be another type of practice that you would ideally want to highlight. User choices and control, this refers to what are the choices that are being made available to a data subject, to someone whose data is being collected by a given entity. Retention, security, all these are different types of statements that you might find in the text of a privacy policy and for which we've collected annotation looking at the text of these 115 privacy policies. And so having done that, we've been able to effectively start looking at questions such as, and so this is to give you a sense for the magnitude of what we're talking about. We have in the order of about 23,000 annotations. These annotations come from people who are trained, have a legal background, understand privacy, right? So those annotations are very high quality annotations, but they're not perfect, as it turns out. So one of the challenges that you are faced with when you have three different annotators looking at the text of a privacy policy, right, these annotators will not necessarily always agree. Sometimes someone will see something and somebody else might not necessarily see it. So they might occasionally disagree. So even when you have these sorts of annotations, you have to make some assumptions about what it's going to take to decide whether or not you're actually seeing something meaningful, something that you might potentially want to use to train these classifiers that we're going to be building. And so typically what we have found to be an acceptable way of approaching this is to say, well, if two out of three of my three experts agree on the presence of a given statement, then I'm going to consider that to be a correct statement. I'm going to consider that to be something worth using to train my classifiers. If only one out of three sees it, perhaps it's true, perhaps the other two missed it, but I'm going to assume that that's probably not there, right? And so when you do that, you still end up with a very large number of valuable annotations, and you can start using these things to potentially build classifiers. So what sorts of classifiers would I want to build? Well, as a first step, if I want to train computers to understand privacy policies, I should at least be able to train my computer to recognize different paragraphs in the text of a policy, or we're going to call them segments, and understand what these paragraphs are talking about. What sorts of practices are they discussing? Are they discussing the collection of data by a first party? Are they discussing the sharing of data with a third party? Are they talking about options that might be available to the user in terms of opting in or opting out of different practices? Are they talking about my ability as a data subject to review what data has been collected about me, correct that data if it's incorrect? Are they talking about the security of my data? What are the different kinds of things that are being discussed in different segments of a policy? And so we took all these annotations that we had collected and started building classifiers to do that. And there are obviously lots of different techniques out there, and my goal here is not to give you a lecture on natural language processing at a deep level. There are tons and tons of different techniques. The simplest techniques are actually easy to understand, and they sometimes work pretty well. So an example of a very simple technique is known as logistic regression. And what you do is you're basically building linear formulas that are going to be looking at the presence of different terms, for instance, in a fragment of text. And then you're going to weigh the frequency, for instance, at which these the terms occur in that text. And you're going to determine some kind of a plane or hyperplane. And if you're above that hyperplane, you're going to say, oh, yes, right, because there are at least, you know, this many times this term and that term in this particular fragment. This fragment probably talks about this particular topic. And if you're below that threshold, then you're going to say, well, that fragment doesn't seem to be discussing that topic. That's actually an example of something that works reasonably well, especially if you start processing these words. For instance, you use stemming, which is a way to go back to the root of the words. If you focus on words that are partly, meaningful rather than articles and things that you're going to find pretty much in any piece of text, if you start doing those kinds of things and potentially also looking at what people refer to as n-grams, which is rather than treating single words by themselves, potentially start looking at combinations of words. So, for instance, in privacy, the notion of personally identifiable information, right, these three words together, often are going to be, you know, very interesting, and they're going to mean something that's very specific to privacy. And if you were to look at these three words separately, it would not necessarily be as indicative of anything, because these words can appear in a variety of other types of context in general. Right. So those are the kinds of things that you can do, and there are tons of other terms that I'm not going to bother you with, but we're going to be looking at these as that, as just a bunch of different techniques, right? And then I'll give you some insight into what are some of the things that people are looking at today in natural language processing and how some of these things can actually help us improve the performance of very basic techniques. So there are a bunch of numbers here. You're probably feeling dizzy as we speak. You wish you hadn't come this evening. So I'm going to actually just explain very quickly what you're supposed to see. So when you evaluate classifiers, for instance, on the text of a privacy policy to determine whether or not these classifiers are able to recognize the discussion of different types of practices, you're going to be concerned, as is always the case in machine learning, about a few different metrics. For instance, you're going to be interested in precision of your classifier. And precision refers to whether or not what you think you see a given practice, you are correct or not. That's the term of precision. Recall is another type of metric. Recall has to do with what percentage of the times when this practice is discussed in a given text, am I actually going to be able to recognize it? Right. So it's easy to come up with a technique that's 100% precise with 0% recall. Right. Basically, I'm always going to say no. I'm never going to make a mistake as a result. So I'm going to be 100% precise, but my recall will be zero. Right. And similarly, I could have a precision of zero and a recall of 100%, right, by basically saying yes all the time. Yes, I see that this is discussing, you know, first-party collection, and you're going to say that systematically. Your recall will be perfect. You're never going to miss anything because you're always saying yes, it's there, but your precision will be terrible, right? So we don't want either one of those two. We would like actually to have the best of both worlds. So ideally, we're going to be looking for techniques, classifiers that are doing well both in terms of precision and recall. That means they're going to catch many of the practices that are discussed in the text of privacy policies, and they're going to be very precise, right? They're going to tend to be correct. When they're saying this is discussing this type of practice, they're going to typically be on the mark, right? And so what you're seeing here is you're seeing a bunch of triples, three different numbers, that show you the precision, recall, and an F1 metric. So F1 is a very popular metric in machine learning. You may not have heard of it. How many of you know anything about machine learning? Does F1 mean something to some people in this room? Okay, so think about F1 as being this magic metric that tries to measure whether you're both precise and good at your recall, right? So this is the metric that you're really looking for. So the third number in these triples would be ideally 100%. If you had a perfect technique, this would be 100%. It would mean you're always correct and you're catching everything, right? And so what you're supposed to see here in this table, you're seeing a bunch of different practices. Each row, each line here corresponds to different practice, like first-party collection, which has to do with the discussion of what is the first party doing, what data they're collecting, third-party sharing collection. So what data, for instance, is being shared with third parties? Is my data being sold to somebody? User choice, what options do I have as a data subject in terms of opting in or opting out of different practices and so on. And then you're seeing a bunch of different techniques in these columns here. And you're not necessarily supposed to understand what these things refer to. LR is actually referring to that first technique I sort of explained with a bit of hand-waving, logistic regression. SVM is a bit more complex. That stands for support vector machines. And then CNN is what people are very excited about these days. So these are the so-called convolutional neural network types of techniques. This is what people refer to as deep learning. And what you're seeing here is, by and large, the technology today, right, and I'm obviously skipping a lot of details, enables you to actually do reasonably well. Look, for instance, at the very last column here, and look at the third number in that column. So you're seeing, for instance, 0.78 for first-party collection and use. That means that, by and large, we're doing a pretty good job 78% of the time, and I'm simplifying this a little bit. Third-party sharing collection, we're getting to 79%. Do not track, and I'm not going to explain what that is, we're getting to actually 100%. So some of these numbers are actually looking pretty good, and then occasionally there are certain things that we're not doing as well with. So, for instance, if you look at data retention, which is somewhere in the middle, this is like the fifth practice, you're typically going to have an F1 that might be around 0.35, 0.43, 0.40, and actually zero in the case of convolutional neural networks. That sounds terrible. Zero, right? That's, how can you be that bad, right? I don't know. So something went wrong there. What is going on is that some of these data practices are not very common. Privacy policies don't discuss these kinds of topics very often. And so as a result, when you have very little data, it's actually very hard to train classifiers to do very well. And occasionally you're going to see these terrible results. And so the challenge, effectively, is to actually do a good job on practices that are not typically discussed in privacy policies. Those practices that you have a very small number of instances of in the corpus that you have collected. And so these are some of the things that we're going to be discussing. And I realize this is fairly high level. But based on these initial results, we've actually been able to build initial classifiers, and we've been scanning privacy policies at scale. So we have a website, for instance, where you can go and review 7,000 different privacy policies that have been automatically annotated by our classifiers and that are going to tell you directly, and this is color-coded, if you want to look, for instance, at all the statements in a privacy policy that discuss first-party collection or that discuss third-party sharing or that discuss choices made available to users, you pick one of these colors, you click on one of those links, and you're going to directly see highlighted in the text of a privacy policy every single paragraph that discusses those types of issues. So this is all available for you to play with. It's actually at this particular URL if you can read it, and I'll provide it again at the end of the presentation. So you can effectively click on one of these practices. Here on the left, you see first-party collection is the top practice. In this case, there are 93 different segments that discuss privacy policies. The second one, you've got 54 segments that have been identified discussing third-party sharing and collection, and so on. And you can actually go pretty deep with these kinds of classifiers. You can look also at what sort of data is being collected. So is this collecting actually my email? Is this collecting my phone number? Is this collecting my IP address? You can actually go pretty far with these sorts of techniques, as it turns out. And so there are more screens of this type, but I'm not going to dwell on that. You're welcome to take a look at this by yourself if you'd like to. So one interesting task that we decided to focus on a bit more was the task of trying to actually find choices. So choices are very important, right? And in many regulations, under many regulations, users are supposed to be given some kind of a choice. So for instance, under the Hong Kong Data Privacy Ordinance, there are situations where you should be able to opt out of certain practices. In Europe, under GDPR, most of the time when sensitive data is going to be collected from you, they're not allowed to do so until they have your consent up front. So this is called opting in. So many privacy policies actually contain, deep in the text of the privacy policy, some links that will give you access to choices, to privacy settings, that you can actually use to indicate whether you want to opt out of a given practice or opt in to that practice. Typically, the opt-out links are going to be the ones that are going to be the toughest to find. The reason why they're the toughest to find is that under regulations where users can opt out, as an entity that's collecting data by default, you have no incentive to make it easy for the users to find these opt-outs. You're going to try to make it as difficult as possible. And so you find many of these opt-out links to be nearly impossible to actually find. But what if you had a machine learning model that you had built, a classifier that you had built, that was able to look at the text of the privacy policy, all 10 pages of it, and automatically zoom in on these opt-out choices? So one of the things that we did is we said, well, perhaps we can build such a classifier. And so we've actually built these classifiers. We started early with some simple techniques. We found that there are lots of different choices that are effectively exposed to users in privacy policies. This can range from deactivating accounts, deleting accounts, but also opting out of your email being collected or receiving emails, opting out of third-party cookies. There are all sorts of different things that you might potentially be able to find in the text of privacy policies. And so we looked at our corpus, and we looked at whether or not we had enough data to potentially train some classifiers. And these are some of the numbers we had for different practices. In particular, for the opt-outs, we found that for opt-out links and opting out of being contacted by a company, we had actually a meaningful amount of data. And so we proceeded to try and build some classifiers. In our first attempt, again, we looked at a bunch of different techniques. You don't need to understand what these techniques do. Our first attempt were sort of fairly average. We're getting to an F1 of about 0.63. And if you look at this more carefully, you find that our accuracy was sort of so-so, and our recall was so-so, nothing that you could really brag about. But we continue to work on that, and there are lots of different techniques here I don't have the time to really explore in detail in a presentation like this, but we've actually reached a point now where we're getting precision of 93% and recall of 98%. So we're actually at a point now where we're building a browser plugin, and we're planning to release this browser plugin by the end of the summer or potentially in September at the latest. And with this browser plugin, if you install it in your Firefox or Chrome browser, you're going to be able to automatically identify options that are made available to you to opt out of different types of practices. So this is actually feasible today. This is a tool that will be made available very soon. So that's an example of some of the things that we can do. And as I said, we have already an early version of this that's available on this Explore website that I mentioned earlier, where you can already find these opt-out links as they're being extracted from policies. But this is not as usable as we would like it to be. So we believe that a browser plugin will really be the way to go. So that's an example of something that you can do already today. But the trend in natural language processing, so you might say, okay, you've talked about, you know, building these classifiers, that sounds all great, but truly, you know, what I read about in natural language processing these days is not so much about, you know, convolutional neural networks and definitely not SVM or logistic regression. There are actually much more interesting techniques that are being developed. So there's been a number of really interesting developments over the past 2-3 years in natural language processing. And many of these developments revolve around a concept that I'd like to explain for a couple of minutes because it's relatively easy to understand. And this is what people refer to as word embeddings. And so here I'm going to go a bit deeper into the technology, but only so deep, so it should be actually fairly easy to understand. So traditionally, if you go back to the example I mentioned earlier when I was talking about logistic regression, I was just talking about counting the frequency at which different words occur in a given segment, in a given fragment of text. So that sort of works okay, and all the results I showed you so far were based on these kinds of technologies. But in fact, you're going to find that there are many different words that can actually mean roughly the same thing. And so if you build classifiers that are going to be depending on the presence of the exact term in a given fragment of text, you're going to build classifiers that are potentially very, very brittle. Right? Instead, people have come to realize that perhaps you could actually define words in terms of the context within which they appear. And you can actually represent each word using vectors, where vectors are going to capture the terms that are within the vicinity of the word and where it appears. And so this is what people refer to as word embeddings. There are multiple techniques to do these things. But the bottom line, and this goes back to an observation that was made by a linguist back in the 1950s. This was a British linguist whose name is John Firth. He basically said a word is characterized by the company it keeps. And so this is a way of saying if a given word appears with a collection of other words, that's going to be defining a context within which this word might be used. And so rather than trying to just discover the word by itself, I'm actually going to try to discover the context where this word is likely to appear. Right. So an example is, think about the word cookie. Right. So the word cookie, for those of you who like to eat, might, you know, be associated with chocolate chip cookies or whatever your favorite cookie might be. Right. But if you think about cookies in terms of privacy, the word that might come along with cookies might be browser. Right. And so those are two different types of contexts where the word cookie might appear. And so ideally, what you want to do is not so much discover the word cookie. You want to actually discover the context. You want to see whether you've got cookie together with chocolate chip or cookie together with browser. And those will define two different types of context. And so can we actually build classifiers that are capable of discovering these types of contexts? So word embeddings, there are different kinds of word embeddings that people have developed over the past few years. So you've got, for instance, vectors that are going to be looking at the co-occurrence of other words. So for instance, again, think about chocolate and chip along with cookie, or think about browser. Or you're going to have vectors that are going to be looking at capturing linguistic context. So again, you could have a context that pertains to privacy, where cookie will correspond to cookie in the context of a browser, and you might have cookie that's associated with people who like desserts and sweets, right? And so those would be examples of different kinds of cookies. And so what I want to show you over the next few slides is examples of results that we've obtained using word embeddings built in a privacy-specific context versus word embeddings that people have developed over the past few years looking at more generic collections of documents. And so this is all fairly new stuff. This is technology that really has come out over the past 3 years, as I said earlier, right? And so the kinds of things that you can do, so there is, for instance, a collection of word embeddings that people have developed. It's known as Glovi. And Glovi is basically a collection of these associations of words that people have developed by looking at very large collections of documents. One of the beautiful things about these word embeddings, I forgot to mention that, is that you don't need to have annotations from experts. Word embeddings are actually the result of unsupervised machine learning techniques. What do I mean by unsupervised? Unsupervised means that you're basically going to process a very large number of documents, in this case, without knowing anything about the words in these documents. But you're going to compile a bunch of statistics to find associations between collections of words. And on the basis of these associations, you're going to build models. And these models will then be used to build these vectors. So instead of representing word just as a single term, every word now is going to be represented as a vector that corresponds, for instance, to these various contexts where this word might appear. And using representations that are now vector-based about every word that you find in a document, you're going to transform a document that initially was a collection of words into a collection of vectors. And you're going to start processing these collections of vectors, applying the same kinds of machine learning techniques that we're using normally in natural language processing, except that now a word has become a lot richer. A word now is a vector of different possible contexts. Right? And so what I want to show you in particular is what we've been able to accomplish by building these word embeddings by focusing specifically on the text of privacy policy. So again, there's no need here to have experts annotating the text of privacy policies. I can just take a large collection of privacy policies, I can crank out my algorithms on this, and then automatically I'm going to be generating a bunch of different types of embeddings, representations of different words. And so if I do this across generic documents, I'm going to get generic embeddings. So, for instance, cookies might be associated both with browsers and chocolate chip cookies, right? If I look at a generic collection of documents, including perhaps, you know, cooking recipes and documents describing internet technologies, that's what I'm going to get. Now, on the other hand, if I train my word embeddings solely by using the text of privacy policies, I might actually be able to build embeddings that are going to be much more powerful when it comes to analyzing the text of privacy policies. And so that's one of the things that we've done recently. We've looked at a collection of privacy policies. So we have about 300,000 privacy policies that we've collected from our mobile apps on the Google Play Store. And we're able to leverage that text and crank this stuff with these machine learning algorithms and build these sorts of word embeddings. And what you start to get with these word embeddings is really interesting, because the areas where we used to struggle the most, the areas where we used to have very small number of instances in these annotated privacy policies, the 115 annotated privacy policies I was talking about earlier, those are actually the areas where I'm going to get the biggest benefit by starting to use these word embeddings. Because all of a sudden, basically what is happening is I'm going to get the wisdom of this analysis that I've done by cranking out the text of 300,000 privacy policies, looking at all sorts of associations that I could not capture when I only looked at 115 policies. And I'm going to be able to leverage that when I start building classifiers that use representations where every word now is a vector instead of just being a word. And so I can use the very same annotations I had for my annotators, but now I'm replacing every word by these much richer vectors that are going to tell me that these words tend to be associated with a bunch of different contexts. And so using the same techniques, but now using these word embeddings to represent every single term in the text of the privacy policies, I'm getting some significant improvements. So my F1 value, for instance, for data security, which was one of the practices where I had like 0.45, right, I'm getting roughly a 10% improvement. Policy change, this is to do with text that says, we reserve the right to change your privacy policy. If we change your privacy policy, we're going to notify you. Data retention. So you're getting actually very significant improvements in your ability now to extract a variety of different statements and a variety of different practices. So one way of visualizing this, right? So I realize this is potentially a bit abstract, but one way of visualizing this is to actually project these vectors, right, on a two-dimensional space. So you can use component analysis, if that rings a bell. Some of you are engineers, I assume, and have done some math, so that must mean something. So if you do component analysis, right, and you look, for instance, at the generic embeddings for some of the words that I was talking about, you find, and so you have to look at the scale here, and I know that this might be a bit difficult to read, but this is roughly, this is minus 4, minus 3, this is 0, I think this is 3, 4, and 5, or something like that, right? And what you're finding here is if you look, for instance, at the term cookie and the term browser, you find that these words are actually separated by a fairly large distance when you're looking at this in the context of generic embeddings. That means embeddings that have been built looking at a generic collection of documents. Say, for instance, you take Wikipedia, you take the dictionary, right? You take very generic types of documents, right? Party and food, on the other hand, will be much closer, right? And you're going to find, for instance, that collection and data and tracking are also fairly distant. When you look at in-domain embeddings, that means those are the embeddings that I was able to build by processing only the text of privacy policies I've collected, right? Then all of a sudden you find that cookies are pretty close to browsers, pretty close to tracking. You find that data and collection are very close. And you find that party and privacy are also very close because there are discussions of first-party collection and third-party collection. And so that's a way of visualizing what I just described. So you have now much more specialized types of representations of words that pertain specifically to how these words actually appear in the text of privacy policies. And without getting annotators, right, human beings to actually annotate anything, you can sort of leverage these embeddings, take annotations for a small number of privacy policies, the same group of 115 privacy policies, and enrich these annotations, right, with these very expressive models that capture knowledge collected from the text of 300,000 privacy policies. Right? So those are examples of improvements that we've been able to accomplish. Now, the kinds of... So how many privacy policies do you need to train these embeddings? So these technologies are actually very expensive, right? So I'm burning a ton of computing credits in the cloud as I run these techniques. So you have a bunch of computers, and they're running for several days, right? This is what it really takes. So this is sort of deep neural network techniques that process all these documents. And so it's good to ask yourself, well, how many policies do I really need to get these improvements? And the answer is, well, the number of policies that you need is going to vary based on how many labels you have, how much data you already have annotated by human experts. So when it comes to, for instance, practices discussed in privacy policies for which you already have a large number of statements that have been annotated by human annotators, then you only need a relatively small amount of data to be processed by these word embeddings. So for instance, if you look at first-party collection, which is the set of privacy statements that that's the most common in the text of privacy policies, you find that you only need in the order of about 1,000 or so privacy policies before you're basically saturating. On the other hand, if you look at data retention, which is something that's a lot less common in the text of privacy policies, data retention has to do with how long is my data being kept by this entity that collects data about me. So some policies might say, okay, we only keep your data for a year, or, you know, we erase your data as soon as we don't need it. Most policies remain silent on these things. And so those are the types of statements that are a lot less common. And so here, it really helps to process a much larger number of privacy policies to build these word embeddings. And basically, at that point, you can benefit from the power of these embeddings to supplement the small number of human annotations that you have. All right. So there are lots of other techniques, and I'm trying to be mindful of the time here. So, for instance, one of the most popular techniques these days that has come out, this is just over the past 2 years, has come out from Google, and it's known as BERT, just as the character in Sesame Street, believe it or not. And BERT is a pretty amazing technique, and I'm not going to describe it in a huge amount of detail, but it's a technique that looks at building even more powerful types of contextualized representations of terms, sort of looking at the text that you have by looking in both directions. So it's actually bidirectional. It goes forward and backwards, and it actually goes in basically pretty much any direction. And so these things are actually very powerful. And you would think that the BERT embeddings that are made available by Google would actually beat everything that we've done because they've been trained on such a large amount of data. Well, we actually compared how much better we can do with BERT compared with the in-domain embeddings that we've built. And as it turns out, when you continue to focus on practices that are not disclosed very often in the text of privacy policies, the in-domain embeddings continue to be this technique, which, if you look at the NLP community, people are very severely depressed right now in the natural language processing community because this technique has beaten everything that they've developed over, you know, the past two decades. And yet here, we find that these in-domain embeddings are actually still beating this technique for a number of different types of practices. So that's an interesting sort of statement. Now, we've not... So if this sounds very technical, let me tell you that this is about as far as I'm going to go in terms of talking about the technologies. What I'd like to do over the next 10 minutes or so is give you a sense for some of the other things we can do with these types of technologies. So at this point, hopefully, you believe me that we can do a reasonable job at extracting automatically a bunch of different statements from the text of privacy policies. And so what can I do with this capability? Well, as I said earlier, one of the things you can do is you can, for instance, automatically extract choices from the text of privacy policies. Another thing you can do is you can help people check whether their technologies are actually compliant with different types of regulations. So we've actually built a tool that has been made available to regulators and that we've also used working with different companies that enables people to look at the technology. This has been built for mobile apps specifically, that enables people to check whether a particular mobile app is actually compliant with a given regulation. How do we do that? Well, we do two things. One is we read the text of the privacy policy, and the other thing that we do is we look at the code of the mobile app. And if the text of the privacy policy says that, for instance, this app doesn't collect location, and on the other hand, we look at the code of the app and we see that it collects location, then we know we have a compliance issue, right? Or at least a potential compliance issue. And so we've developed technology to do that, and the way it works is that this is, again, running in the cloud, so this is actually a pretty powerful tool. We can automatically scan all the apps in the Google Play Store, at least all the free apps in the Google Play Store. So we, for instance, did a full scan of over 1 million apps not too long ago. We shared the results with the Federal Trade Commission, identifying a number of different apps that had potential compliance issues. We've also used the same tool working with several very large companies that had mobile apps and that were concerned that perhaps they were not compliant with the European GDPR regulation. And so I've got probably more slides than I can cover and definitely more numbers than you care to see. But in a nutshell, these things work quite well, right? And to give you a sense for how much traction you can get with this stuff, so people in the past had been trying to do this manually. So regulators once a year come together, they organize big sweeps of different technologies. In 2014, I think 30 different regulators from around the world said, let's spend a week just looking at mobile apps and see if we can find mobile apps that have compliance issues. In 1 week, these 30 different regulatory agencies, including some of the largest ones around the world, I think including the Hong Kong authority responsible for privacy, in Europe, a bunch of different regulatory agencies from a number of European countries, in the US, the FTC, the organizations in Canada, and so on, these guys were able to analyze a total of 1,200 apps, right? In contrast, we're actually able to analyze an app every few seconds. So we can analyze about 70,000 apps per day, right? And we're able to scan basically 1 million apps in a very short period of time. And when you do that, you get all of a sudden a pretty broad picture of what is the current state of affairs, for instance, with mobile apps. So we found that on average, an app has about 3-point-some compliance issues, which is very alarming if you think about it. Right? These apps actually access a lot of very sensitive information, your location, your calendar, your camera, etc. And there are still a bunch of apps that don't have privacy policies. So that's an example of something that we've been able to do. In fact, when you look at this analysis, and I'm going to spare you a lot of details, you find that one of the areas where you've got the biggest compliance issues has to do with the use of third-party libraries. So the name of the game with mobile apps these days is that we've tried to make everything easy for developers. So developers don't need to know very much. And in particular, when it comes to revenue models, right, many of these apps rely, for instance, on advertising. How do they do advertising? Do they have to recruit companies that want to advertise directly? No, app developers never have to find anybody to advertise. All they need to do is they need to import a library, right, in their code, and this library will be connecting to an advertising network, and this advertising network will automatically collect information such as the location of the user and potentially contacts list and all sorts of other sensitive things. And as it turns out, many of the compliance issues actually have to do with the fact that the practices of these mobile ad networks are actually not properly disclosed in the privacy policies of the mobile apps, especially mobile apps that don't have a privacy policy to start with. But while under many different regulations, you have to actually declare that you're collecting sensitive information, like location information. So, for instance, under GDPR in Europe, if you want to collect information, not only you need to declare it, but you need to get explicit consent from the user. Many apps actually fail to do that. So that's another example of applications that we've been able to basically build using these technologies. These are just screens of the tools that we've developed in this space and that we've made available to regulators. But before I wrap up, I want to tell you about something that's potentially even more exciting. So this is work in progress. So we've gone back to the first question that I asked. And this had to do, if you remember, with the idea that one-size-fits-all doesn't work when it comes to summarizing privacy policies. And so we came back and basically asked the following question. If you cannot summarize the text of privacy policies in a uniform manner for all users, why not instead allow users to ask whatever question they care about? Don't try to guess what questions they're going to care about. It's going to vary from one person to another. So why not build a privacy assistant that can actually answer questions that people have? Can we actually build that? Is that possible? And so we've started to do research in this space, and this research has made a reasonable amount of progress. I cannot disclose everything yet because we've not published all the work, but at least I'll disclose a few things with you. So when you start trying to build technology like this, there are a number of questions you need to ask yourself, such as what sorts of questions people have to start with? What are the things that they care about? Are people actually able to articulate their privacy questions? Well, if people don't understand anything about privacy, perhaps they're not able to even articulate the questions that they have. Right? How often are these questions ambiguous? How often do they make sense? How often can the questions that people have be answered based on the text of privacy policies? Right? So there are tons and tons of questions like this that you need to be able to answer before you can start making progress in this space. And so we've collected a bunch of different questions that people have about mobile apps when it comes to privacy. So we used crowd workers on Amazon Turk, and we basically showed them a bunch of different apps and asked them each to provide 10 different questions that they might have about these different apps. And so we collected a corpus of about 1,350 questions that people have about privacy policies, and then we showed these questions to legal experts in privacy and asked them to analyze these questions on the basis of a number of different criteria, such as, does this question make sense? Is this question related to privacy, right? Is this question, a question that can be answered based on the text of a privacy policy? So those are the kinds of things that we looked at. And I want to share with you at least a few of the results that we got. So this is how this was conducted. So this is the setup of this study here. These are the screens that people would be shown. They would be shown descriptions of the apps, and then it would be asked to provide questions about privacy related to these different apps. And so here are some of the things that we've been able to collect, right? So like I said, we've collected a bunch of different questions. On average, questions are about 8 words in length, in contrast to the privacy policies that are about 3,000 words in length. And we've asked people with a legal background to also provide answers to these questions. And a typical answer to these questions is about 100 words in length. So that's also something to keep in mind. So here is, for instance, the sort of analysis that we've done. We've looked at what sorts of words people use to ask questions. So often, most of the questions that you can see here have to do with do or does. And so those are questions such as, does this app collect my email? Or does this app collect my location? Or does this app share my location, you know, with a third party? Or will this app, right, very similar type of question. Or what is this app collecting about me, right? Or how is this being collected, right? Or does this app use cookies? So those are some of the things that people have. We looked at the relevance and subjectivity of these questions. So this is analyzed by legal experts who looked at all these different questions one by one, looked at the text of the privacy policies. So it's interesting to know that obviously a fraction of these questions are subjective. That means you may not actually be able to provide necessarily a meaningful answer. An example is my data safe? Right? That's a very subjective question. For instance, some of the questions also are not even related to privacy. So an example of a question we got is, are there any in-game purchases I should be concerned about? Those are questions that people ask, right? Objective questions, so what information are they collecting? And objective question that has nothing to do with privacy, how much does it cost? So those are examples of questions that you're potentially going to get if you allow people to ask questions to your privacy assistant. So these results are not hopeless, right? So there's a good number of questions there that are objective questions and that are related to privacy. So users are not completely hopeless. We might actually be able to help them. But it's not trivial either. You have questions that are very subjective, and you have all sorts of other problems. In terms of the kinds of things that people are concerned about, what is good to see is that the questions that people have actually relating very nicely with the content of privacy policies, at least at some high level. Most questions, or not most questions, but the largest proportion of questions had to do with first-party collection and use. And as it turns out, those are also the statements that are most common in the text of privacy policies. The second most popular category of questions has to do with third-party collection and sharing. So again, that's actually also aligned with the kinds of statements that you find in privacy policies. So those are encouraging things. Not everything is encouraging. So there are a bunch of questions also that don't admit answers. And I'll explain to you why we've done this sort of analysis. So 56% of questions that don't admit answers because they're not typically addressed in the text of privacy policies. So they're actually reasonable questions that people can ask, but you're not going to find the answers to these questions. Like, for instance, has Viber, that's the name of an app, had a data breach in the past? Well, I'm not aware of any privacy policy where a company discloses data breaches that they have. It's a valid, legitimate privacy question. You're not going to find it in the text of privacy policy. So this suggests to us that if we're going to try to build an assistant that can answer these questions, we're going to have to look at other sources of knowledge beyond just the text of privacy policies. We might want to look at news. We might want to look at social media. There are actually other places we might be able to find this information. Another example of a question that's not answerable is a question where the privacy policy is silent. So privacy policies are not necessarily always as detailed as you would like them to be, right? So an example might be, is my data encrypted? That's a very valid question, and that's one that ideally should be discussed in a text of privacy policy. But not all privacy policies are perfect. In fact, as we discussed with mobile apps, there are mobile apps that don't even have a privacy policy. And so you're not going to always be able to answer these questions. So again, you might potentially want to fall back on general background knowledge. So for instance, if someone says, is this app, encrypting my data? And you know that this app, for instance, is in the banking sector, you might be able to say, well, this privacy policy doesn't really say anything about it, but this is a financial organization. It's well established. There's a reasonable chance that they're going to be encrypting your data. Or you could actually analyze the code of the mobile app, as we've done before. As I showed you, we can actually do that. We've been doing this to help regulators with compliance issues. I can actually look at the code of the mobile app and see whether or not it's actually encrypting the data. And I might be able to answer that question based on analysis of the code. So there are actually different options. And so ultimately, what you would want to do is build a privacy assistant that does more than just rely on the text of the privacy policy. Let me continue down the list here, reasons why a question may not be answerable. So another reason might be that the question is vague, right? So an example of a question like that is, who can contact me through the app? Right? What do they mean by that? Right? So this is an example where your privacy assistant ideally would be able to engage in a dialogue with the user to clarify what the user is trying to find out. Right? 4% are questions that are ambiguously phrased. Like these are real quotes, right, from real questions asked by people. Any difficulty to occupy the privacy assistant? So we basically explained to people, as we collected data from them about privacy questions they might have, that they were supposed to imagine that it was a privacy assistant that could answer the questions. And so somebody decided that they were going to ask a question about a privacy assistant. Right? So a dialogue here potentially could help also. Now we're getting to smaller numbers. 7% are subjective questions. Right? So how do I know this app is legit? Well, what do you mean by legit? Right? So again, this is something where you might follow with a dialogue, or you might potentially offer people some general knowledge. You might say, well, this is a reputable app store. There's a reasonable chance that an app in this app store is actually legit, or this may not be a legit or a very popular app store. They're not doing a very thorough job at vetting apps. Perhaps you should not necessarily assume that this one is legit. So there are a number of different categories of scenarios here that ideally you would want to be able to recognize. And so What we've been doing, and so there are a couple of observations here, but what we've been doing recently, we've not published this work, but we've actually made a good amount of progress. That's why I'm not presenting that. I'm just teasing you. We've actually been building classifiers to recognize all these different types of situations. Is a question subjective? Is a question answerable based on text of a privacy policy? Is a question that needs to be disambiguated, right? And we've started to work on various types of templates that would enable us, once we've determined what situation we're in, to then follow up with the user, to either engage in dialogue to clarify things, to also qualify potentially some statements. If a question is subjective, you might want to say, well, I don't exactly know what you mean by legit, but, you know, here's potentially some useful information. Right, those are the kinds of things that you can try to do. And so we're actually working on that as we speak. And so, as Paul mentioned, we have a dinner appointment, so I'm going to try to wrap up in time here. So I'm hoping that I was able to show you that advances in natural language processing over the past few years have actually made it possible to envision functionality that is starting to be able to automatically understand the text of privacy policies. And this could make a huge difference. Privacy is very important. There's more and more data being collected about us. We all care about privacy, as it turns out, but we just don't have the time, we don't have the resources, we don't have the know-how to really be able to keep up with all these disclosures found in the text of privacy policies. And so I'm hoping, and that's what my group is doing, we're hoping to be able to build technology that's going to alleviate the burden on users when it comes to trying to understand everything that happens to their data, enabling them to answer questions, enabling regulators also to vet mobile apps and other technologies at scale, but automatically reading statements in the text of privacy policies, potentially comparing that with different regulatory requirements, with the code potentially of some of the technologies like mobile apps. We're hoping in the process to also support companies and app stores. App stores should be doing a better job also in terms of vetting apps and making sure that they are compliant. They have a responsibility in this area, and they certainly have much more resources than your typical mobile app developers. And so through this kind of research, we're really hoping to, over time, be able to make a difference and eventually offer people privacy assistance that will be able to answer their questions. That's obviously a long-term research project, but that's what research is all about. And so we're hoping along the way to make some early technologies available, early results available to user. The browser plugin that I was talking about, for instance, is an example of that. We've actually been quite successful at this stage at extracting choices that are exposed to users deep in the text of privacy policies, making that more accessible to users. So that's where I'm going to stop. Thank you very much. I hope this was interesting.